Good afternoon, or morning, or no, it's afternoon. It's time for another episode of Webcomics Weekly. It's going to be a little sad today because we are one man short. We're missing our good buddy Chris today. He is out and about, but hopefully we'll find the ability to get over. Yeah, I'm over it.
Oh, with my Irish background, I wanted to do some Irish keening. Oh, Chrissy was a good boy. Oh,
Chrissy boy, the podcast is calling.
But you're not here, so we'll start it without you.
I'm over it already. Who is Chris again?
I love how you went high note on that.
I'm already over it. I think it's sad that I can hit the high note. All right, we'll edit that out in post.
I hope not. That was one of the most beautiful.
Don't worry, we never edit anything out in post.
I was going to say we always say we're going to edit out in post, and all I ever hear is that in the podcast when I hear it is that we're going to edit out in post.
It's too funny when you leave it in. So I wanted to start out the show today by discussing a pro tip that was given to us in our forums and was implemented by a fellow friend and cartoonist, Paul Southworth, with incredible results, and I cannot replicate it. In our forums, and Paul, God, you'll have to forgive me, Paul sent me a direct link, and I can't find my way back to it, but let me see if I can find it. It's in the Webcomic Weekly forum, so if you head to halfpixel.com and go to the forums, and under that you'll see Webcomics Weekly. It's about inking digitally in Illustrator, using the brushes in Illustrator. Now, according to this guy, you get the same effect as Photoshop, same nice brush strokes, but it's all vector. And Paul sent me two strips he's done in this method, and his line quality is unaffected. It is identical.
Really?
Now he's got a cartoon image that's any DPI he needs it to be, and it's at an infinitesimal file size than if he saved it as a Photoshop file or a pixelated file.
Wow.
And I just can't seem to replicate it. I just don't know how to make it work. But there's all kinds of brush sensitivity levels you can set in Illustrator. The only problem that I have is I don't know how to erase a line once I've drawn it. So have you guys screwed with it at all? Have you guys done anything in Vector or Illustrator?
No, the most that I do is I'll place a bitmap line art file into Illustrator and then have it vectorize it. And that's pretty much the extent of most of my stuff is in bitmap. So,
well, it's in the Webcomics Weekly form. It's under digital inking. And what Joshua has told us is if you go into your paintbrush tool preferences, you set the fidelity of the line at 1 and you choose to let it edit selected parts within 3 pixels. And then you can set up individual brushes to use at various thicknesses. And just make sure you choose to have the diameter be pressure sensitive, and you can draw your lines the same way as you do in Photoshop. You just draw the line, then after you finish drawing it, it's a shape. It's a vector shape.
Wow. Well, if that's true, well, then that's all the reason in the world to buy a Cintiq. Mm-hmm.
Oh, God. Any reason to buy a Cintiq, huh?
I'm looking for anything right now. I'm like, any excuse I could use for myself. Why do I need to drop $2,000? Oh, hey, digital inking in Illustrator. That's a good reason. Oh, hey, it's cold outside. Cintiq.
Hey, sweetie. Yes, dear. Did you take the trash out? All right. I can't work this way. I need a Cintiq.
Oh, hey, Scott, if you could just pass along to Angela real quick that the Christmas gift for me from both of you would be a Cintiq this year. That'd be great.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I'll let her know.
It's a lot easier when you make it that right up front, you know.
Well, that's a good resource. So digital inking over in the halfpixel.com forums. And,
so this is a request going out from Scott. What I'm trying to figure out is when I draw that way and I've got my beautiful line that's now vector, what I like to do in Photoshop is sometimes I'll draw a line and let them extend over each other, and then you can go and erase the extra piece. How do you erase the extra piece? Now, I know you. I know how to do it in Flash, because Flash somehow counts it almost as both. It is vector, but it treats it almost as if it's pixel. It lets you erase little parts of it. But can you do that in Illustrator? Help us out.
Well, why don't we? Here's. Have you tried this? Just with my limited experience in Illustrator and freehand. What would happen if you drew a shape over top of that, then selected the line that you're trying to erase and the shape you drew over top of it and went to, I don't know where it is off the top.
Oh, I know what you're going to say. You're going to say Pathfinder, exclude.
Subtract your or exclude. You could do it that way, because I know you can cut shapes out of shapes doing that, and that would be basically the same thing.
Yeah. Well, I tell you what, I wouldn't be so gung-ho to try it if I had not just seen the two example strips Paul did. What I need to do is just fly Paul out here to show me.
Well, you know what we should do, actually? Why don't we, in the weeks ahead, maybe have Paul on for a little bit to have him have us talk us through it. Hi, English language. I'm David Keller.
That's crazy enough to work. Well, anyway, so that's my reverse pro tip today.
That's a good reverse.
Reverse pro tip. Well, should we get into it? Should we dive into the old mailbag?
I believe we
Let's
should.
Let's do it.
All right. One quick request from me to everyone, actually, with mailbag questions. We're getting a lot of questions, which we love. We absolutely love to hear the excitement and the curiosity from you guys. But our one request is, because we get so many of them, we do like to be able to filter them pretty quickly. And unfortunately, there's a tendency with a lot of folks to give their autobiography or a whole big exposition, you know, long laying of pipe before they get to their question. So we would just ask if you could get to the question within a line or two, that would be great, and would help us both do the show and respond to you online and offline kind of thing. So just keep the question short. And then on a personal note, I've noticed that a lot of folks seem to be signing us all up for their newsletters or their comic strip announcements. And just in general, as is always true with net etiquette, please allow for an opt-in rather than an opt-out policy. So ask us before you sign us up for any of your newsletters or comic strip announcements and that sort of thing. All right. So let's move on to the mailbag question this week. Is regarding all right, based on your personal experience, what ad program such as Google AdSense or Project Wonderful has worked best for you? Also, depending on how many visitors you get to your site, can you make more money using a certain one? And this is from Daria Pelig.
That is a good question.
But who wants to jump in on that one?
Well, I've used both, and I've had really good experience with both programs. Google, I found it has been really good, except I will note this on my courting disaster site, where sometimes I deal with issues of sex and relationships and stuff like that. Sometimes the wording of some of the things that go on that website will put Google into a situation where they start sending me public service announcements that you do not get paid for. So if you have any kind of content on your site that is that Google considers questionable, even if you don't consider it questionable, you might be better off going another route, because you're going to end up with public service announcements or PSAs.
That's actually a setting, Brad, in your Google.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, in Google.
I can opt out of that?
No. Well, what you do is you tell hold on a second. I have a crazy 7-month-old who really wants this microphone. And he really wants to add to the conversation. So if you hear any craziness, that's Dylan's that's my nephew Dylan's contribution to this episode of Webcomics Weekly. But even Dylan agrees with me that in the settings of your Google, when you set up your ads, what it does is it gives you an option on what to do if you don't have – if Google has no ads to offer, whether it be it hasn't spidered any keywords or it's unhappy with what you're offering it to base ads off of. You can choose to run an alternate ad and give it a URL. So you could set up a house ad. Mm-hmm. You could have it run just a color or a blank white space, or it'll run those public service ads.
Oh. But either way, you're not getting paid.
I know. I don't think you get paid for the public service ads, no.
Right. You don't get it. So no matter how you set that setting, you're wasting the space with a Google ad if you've got something on your site that they consider objectionable.
But what you can do is set it to instead run you can set up your ad software to run something else. Well, that's a good point, no. But what you can do is you could tell Google to point to the URL that would then serve your normal ads.
I don't follow that one.
Yeah, you lost me there too.
Okay, well, here's the problem. Like, for example, there is a free ad server or ad software program called OpenAds. I use it. It's PHP. It's a breeze to install, especially if you know your way around your server a little bit. And it lets you run ad campaigns. It's what you guys are using. Chris has it set up for Blank Label.
Okay.
So what you do is you tell it different campaigns. You say, 10% of the time run my house ads, 20% of the time, run ads for my cousin, and then, the remaining amount of time run Google. And you can set high priorities, like always run Google ads as a high priority and then run these in the remainder. It's very, very easy to use. You can find it at openads.com.
Oh, I got you. So you're saying run Google as part of and within OpenAds rather than...
Right. The way I have it set up is Google is just one of my campaigns. As far as OpenAds is concerned, Google is one of my clients, and it knows to run Google at a low priority when no other high-priority ads are running. So,
gotcha.
If a software company, let's say a video game, is advertising with me and I've promised them X amount of page views, those run first. And then when they run out, they run the Google ads. So the problem is, what happens if Google isn't serving you any ads? You can't tell Google to maybe you could find a way to tell Google to point to your see, that's the problem. If Google doesn't have an ad to run for you, it's going to run a blank space or a PSA rather than run your ads.
Right.
Open ads will just run Google and you'll end up with something blank. But there's a way to point Google to a URL if there's nothing for it to run. So essentially, I think you could set it up where you could point Google back up to some code that would just run one of your ads. You could set it maybe to run Project Wonderful ads for you.
Oh, well, that would be a good workaround.
Let me research that, and maybe I'll put it in the show notes, or we'll talk about it on next week's show.
And if I have it right in the meantime, the URL for the free, or not the free, but OpenAds is openads.org.
Oh, so. I apologize for that. I should fix in post because I got it wrong. But
that's right. There will be little tidbits like that.
Yeah, OpenAds is real easy, guys. It's just a matter of following the instructions and moving some files over to your server, and you literally just run, you just go to your browser and hit one page and hit start, and it installs it for you, and then it's all done.
Right.
If you most people that have hosting packages have usually a control panel login, and you can just click a couple buttons and set up a database for it to use, and it's really, if I can do it, anybody can do it. It's real easy.
So how do we feel about Project Wonderful?
Ah, okay. I'll chime in on that one if that's all right. The thing about Sheldon for me is that more so maybe than most people, I try to make it so that an 8 or 9 or a 10-year-old could go to the site fairly. Inconsequentially, and by that I mean it's sort of family friendly. And one thing that I do like about Project Wonderful, and Google actually sort of does this by default, but is that I can keep the ad selection pretty, well edited, I guess is one way to say it, which is nice for somebody like myself who wants an 8 or 9 year old also to be able to visit the site as well as an adult. The downside for that for me is that within the Project Wonderful system, my ad rates are kept pretty depressed by that because competition is what boosts your going rate. So mine tends to stay pretty low because I'm rejecting 3/4 of the ads that I get or the bids that I get.
Interesting.
How does Project Wonderful work for the people that are listening that aren't familiar?
Oh, good question. All right. Scott, you want to take that one? Or I can take that one?
Project Wonderful is an ad system that works on a bidding system. So what you do is you go sign up. I believe it's free to sign up. Get yourself some code. Put it on your website. And you now have the ad code running on your system. And so when someone goes to your website, they see that ad space. There's a little button below it that says click here to bid on this ad space, and it lets them know what the current price is set. And that price is set by the market, by the demand for your ad space. So I think, what does it start out at, like 40 cents or 25 cents or something?
No, it starts as low as, I think, a nickel.
I think you can choose your own lowest point.
Yeah. Yeah,
you can
exactly.
Say, you know, I won't accept any ads under, you know, a penny or under 20 cents or what have you.
Oh, awesome.
What's nice about Project Wonderful as opposed to Google is that, as you guys know, Google is very tight-lipped about its statistics, about what its pages it's on, what algorithms it uses to bring up an ad, all that sort of stuff. Whereas Project Wonderful tries to be pretty much as open as you can make it in terms of how many page views for, yesterday did this site give you? How many page views in the last 30 days did this site give you in the last week? What have been the bids over the last 15 days? So you can really track from sort of a community-minded way what you're bidding on and how much you're going to bid, and also vice versa as an advertiser or advertisee. What would be the proper phrase of that?
Advertiser.
Advertiser.
Advertise.
Yeah. If you're an if you're buying an ad, you're an advertiser.
No. If you're presenting a forum for ads, are you an advertiser?
You'd be an advertisee.
Advertise. Oops. Guys, Afghanistani.
Anyway, as an advertisee, you can also see how you can track how people have been feeling about the value and the weight of your site as far as bids go and all that sort of stuff. So it's they've tried to make it as open and as honest as possible, which is kind of a rare and wonderful thing online. So that's good from that perspective. And I think depending on the site you have, you can actually generate a healthy chunk of cash with both. I have a feeling that Project Wonderful probably generates about 10% more a month. Would you guys say that's fair? 10 to 15%, 20% more a month.
More than Google.
Yeah.
Not for me.
Really? Okay.
Something magical happened with my Google stats. They were really crappy for a long time, and then all of a sudden, whatever magical algorithms Google uses clicked over and said, "Wow, this guy gets a lot of traffic. We can start sending him higher profile ads." And then all of a sudden, one day, I've got ads for the new Charlize Theron movies and. You know, the new Cable Guy DVDs coming out, and my revenue went through the roof. Now, it's since died down from then, but
You know what, Scott? I bet what happens is Project Wonderful probably has a ceiling. It's an artificial ceiling, only based on the number and the type of bidders within the system. So for a site your size, you probably can't get a bidder that's of equal value to the number of page views you can serve. Do you know what I mean?
That's true.
Whereas
I see what you're saying.
Like anybody up to maybe a few million pages can get the equivalent worth of what their page views are worth. But when Scott's serving up that many pages, you know, you need a small to mid to Coca-Cola size type advertiser to be able to make that worthwhile for Scott. So I can see why Google would pay out better for you than for someone of Brad or my size.
Yeah, and also, that's interesting. So you think it's because I can't get high enough paying advertisers on Project Wonderful?
Coca-Cola
is not going to be advertising on Project Wonderful. Or at least not yet.
Well, they're not advertising on PvP yet either. But what I'm saying is the chances of me getting that on an off chance are slimmer, I guess, with Project Wonderful.
I guess it's a question of, like, if you imagine, like, two giant YMCA pools and one has 10 people in it and one has 300 people in it, and you're going to get – I don't know why I used the metaphor of a YMCA pool.
I'm just waiting to see where this is going to go.
And one of them has a lifeguard, and the other one has a fat kid that's eating all the donuts on the side, and the other YMCA pool is closed on Saturdays, and it's no fair to parents. My metaphor completely breaking down.
Just wrestle that metaphor to the ground. You can do it. You can do this.
And one of them has a wave pool for young kids, but it's too yellow to go in, and it's gross.
Okay, that's it. I'm jumping in.
No, Google essentially has an advertiser pool of tens of thousands, maybe 100,000. And Project Wonderful has an advertiser pool of probably 1,000 to 10,000, I would say,
right.
Advertisers. That's just a rough guess. I don't even know. So I'm just assuming that in that pool of advertisers for Google – the ability of someone in that pool to pay a much higher rate for what they know is, you know, what 10, 20, 30 million page views are worth is higher.
Plus, I think Google uses a much better kind of chlorine and just has that one sign up there that says, welcome to our pool. There's no pee in it. Please keep it that way.
And that's classy, really.
I also wonder if this is the case. For example, I have a large inventory of page views. I have 12 million page views usually total a month, and let's say Google gets about a third to a quarter of those. Google will fill them all up. But let's say that Project Wonderful doesn't fill them up. Does it just display the last ad bid even if that person isn't paying for it, or do they display every time it's See, that's the thing is I'm getting a CPM from Google. I'm getting paid per impression, where with Project Wonderful I'm getting paid per day.
Per day and per a percentage of a day.
So, yeah.
If somebody bids on PVP and they're up there for 18 hours of the day, then they'll pay for two-thirds of a day or three-fourths of a day.
Project Wonderful is leasing the inventory space for all of my viewers, whereas Google is paying me per impression per viewer.
Right.
Yeah.
Is Google paying you per impression or per click?
No, per impression.
Oh, okay.
Why? Are you set up to do per click with Google?
No. I to be honest with you, I couldn't remember which one it was, so I figured I'd get that. Make sure I was making that clear.
No, they're paying me per impression.
Well, my advice, and take this for what it's worth, is that on Sheldon, I use a combination of Project Wonderful and Google, and for me, it's a matter of aesthetics. But also, I like to see when one is kicking in higher than the other, and to see why. And sometimes you can figure out the algorithms behind Google suddenly charging you more. Or paying more. And the fun and interesting thing that I found about Google is, you know, it's based on the words you use in your blog and all that sort of stuff. And anytime you make any sort of passing reference to anything that might be in some way pharmacological or pharmaceutical, it's amazing how many ad dollars from the U.S. pharmaceutical industry are poured into Google AdSense because your ad rates just spike. If you can find some sort of weird reason in your blog to mention some random men's hair replacement system, then your Google ad system will spike.
My friend Gary told me that. My friend Gary wrote me one day. He sent me this word. It was this big, long word, and I said, "What is that?" He says, "That's what you need to put in your blog today. It is the highest paying keyword on Google Ads right now." And I'm like, I'm not just going to add it, because that's another thing. Google Ads is really, really diligent about making sure you're not trying to manipulate the system.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, that's what I'm saying. You can't abuse that. But if you can, you will notice it. I guess is one way to say when you start writing. Because I've had things where we're passing references to some joke that I made, and Google picked it up as being some pharmaceutical reference. So I got a whole bunch of Propecia ads or something. And all of a sudden, the rate goes through the roof, you know. And I literally wasn't trying it, but only in doing it did I notice that the ads even came up. And I had made some joke about, you know, hey, I'm getting gray hair, or I was going bald or something. I don't know what I said. But all of a sudden, there's all these men's hair replacement systems that were popping up.
I made a comment about how I had taken DayQuil, thinking it was NyQuil, and I ended up not being able to sleep because I was all hopped up on it. And a friend of mine said... yeah, that's why those kids are buying DayQuil, because kids are buying it and getting high off of it. And I wrote a blog post about how, oh God, man, I understand why these kids are buying DayQuil and getting high off of it, because woo! And I got a bunch of people getting really upset with me, like saying, well, great, now you've advertised it. Now the kids that didn't know will be able to figure it out. And you know, you need to be more responsible about what you blog. And I made this big post about, look, a lot of people are saying that I shouldn't have made this post and it was irresponsible. I cannot believe that there's any great number of kids getting high off DayQuil. I don't think that's the biggest problem in our country. And Google Ads picked up on it, and every ad on my site for a week was, is your kid hooked on DayQuil?
Oh, my God. Well, you know what? That kind of brings us full circle to something that Dave touched on earlier that is an interesting topic I'd like to explore, and that is editing on your website for content. Dave says he likes to keep his place family-friendly. Scott just said that, you know, he gets taken to task for things he puts in his blog sometime. How important is it to monitor the content of your website, or is it important? Clearly, you guys, I think it's very important. And is it worth what you're losing, Dave, in terms of what you might be making on advertisement? And just talk about that for a little bit, because I think that's a really important concept to a lot of people that are starting out.
For me, it is, and I'll tell you why. And let me start over again.
Okay, there's a
pool.
What?
You're at the YMCA.
There's a pool.
You've got the towel and your Adidas slippers on, and you're ready to go change, but there's just too many people in the locker room, and you're feeling shy. So what do you do? Well, what I do is I go to the candy machine first, get myself a Snickers, take a break, wait until there's a few less people in the locker room, then I'll go change. And that's the Dave Kellett secret to getting nude in a public locker room. All right. Webcomics for me are what you have to realize is that the mediums are different. In newspapers, you were appealing to a general audience. You were appealing to a broad group that was everything from 6-year-olds to 66-year-olds, and or 9 to 99, as the old joke used to be. And so you had to keep it family-friendly. Online, the opposite is true. Everyone immediately gravitates towards doing and saying what they want to say because obviously there's less editorial restrictions and there's a freedom and there's something wonderful about that. Well, my thinking with Sheldon is that there is actually still a market, and I use that word intentionally, a market for something that's family-friendly and that kids and adults can read. So that's an intentional business choice on my part. And by choosing that, I maybe remove myself from a few hundred dollars extra of ad money, but the fact for me is business-wise, I can make those few hundred dollars in a day by someone buying original art. So it's better for me to build up my core audience and be true to the marketing that I'm trying to build up for the strip, which is a family friendliness, and leave off the advertising money, knowing that the loyalty that my readers will give the strip for being true to itself will actually pay off in terms of book sales and original art sales. So that's my business thinking.
What are your thoughts on that, Scott? Because I'm interested to hear I know what I think on this, but I want to know what you think.
Well, I think it was Dave that said that an artist is never truly alive until their parents are dead, or never truly free until their parents are dead. And I certainly feel that from my dad. My dad really wishes that I would write a comic strip that is a comic strip that Charles Schulz would write. But that's not the story I want to tell. That's not the humor that is from me. So you guys know me in real life. You know I got a raunchy mouth and I like off-color jokes, and I certainly like creating awkward moments. I find great humor in that. But I've tried to keep my strip as broad as possible and still get to tell the stories I want to tell. There's a lot of innuendo in PvP. There's a lot of silly humor and offensive humor. But at the heart of it, the intent behind the humor is pure. And it's not ever violent or demeaning. And I think that really saves my butt a lot. I grew up with a very amorous set of parents. It was not uncommon to see my dad pinching my mom's butt or something like that, or them giggling. But they loved each other. It was never overtly, it was never sexual or inappropriate. It was always from a place of love, and the two of them just really loved each other. So, listen, I can do grab-assy stuff in PvP and not have it be gratuitous. The rule I follow is nothing that you wouldn't see on a primetime sitcom. Unfortunately, that's getting to be more and more. I think at this point I could be doing a lot more based on that criteria. So I'm saying a primetime sitcom, maybe a late 80s, early 90s at this point. Mm-hmm. But you sacrifice, I guess, a little bit. I think there's a balance to find. I know the Penny Arcade guys and like Control-Alt-Delete have very, very broad audiences, and they have no holds barred. They'll talk about anything. They'll curse all the way up to the mother of all curse words. And but they're approaching a younger audience, you know? Mm-hmm. I don't know. You tell me. Maybe I'm stupid. Maybe if I made my strip more about video games and the F word, I'd have more money coming in right now. But what's important to me is that I tell the stories I want to tell. And
yeah, I can say pretty assuredly that if you did go towards video games and curse more, you would probably have more of an income. But that's not the story you want to tell, and it's got to flow naturally from you, or else there's no energy behind it. There's no creativity behind it. You know?
There's a perfect example I give everybody. I love to curse, and I don't necessarily buy into the whole problem society has with bad words, especially words that are based around poop. My God. But, you know, I think there's a time and a place for everything, and there's a time and a place where that's appropriate. I think that when you watched the first time Star Trek, The Next Generation was in a movie, Data said the S word. The only reason that was powerful is because it had been years and Data had never said it. If Data always said the S word, it wouldn't mean anything. There's a great movie called The Frisco Kid. Have you ever seen it? It's got Gene Wilder and Harrison Ford in it.
Yeah.
It's a movie about a Hasidic Jew that comes to America to be a rabbi, and it's during the Old West times, and he kind of hooks up with this bandit Harrison Ford is playing to help him get to San Francisco, and there's a whole scene where this rough and tumble bandit Harrison Ford is trying to teach this Jewish rabbi how to say the S word and to say it right. And it's an endearing and very genuinely funny scene that would not work if they were saying shoot or poop.
Right.
But it's not for everybody. That's a PG movie. It's for people that are old enough to handle that word. And I think that's the balance I'm trying to strike.
Well, and what I was saying before about there's the creative decision first about what story do you want to tell. But then after that, and it does have to come after that, the marketing decision is if Penny Arcade was genuine and sweet, the 18 to 30 year old guys, and it's probably that mostly that read Penny Arcade, wouldn't want to read it.
Yeah, no, you're right. That is 100%
true. You have to write for the audience that you have, and Penny Arcade has probably a male dominated audience and probably a little bit, a lot bit more tech oriented, more video game oriented, probably a little bit less dating oriented than your average reader. And so they write to that, you know.
Yeah, I got to say, as much as I really do respect Dave, your position you take on this, and it might be something that I would probably do well to emulate. I always had a problem with trying to make decisions on what was best for my reader past my actual comic strip. You know what I mean?
Why I say the creative decision has to come first.
Right. Right, because I've always kind of had the attitude that, you know, if you're on the web and even if you're a kid, if you're a kid, I kind of leave it up to the parents to do the policing. And I kind of figure if you're an adult on the web and this is the first time you've seen content that was something other than what you've seen on network television, then you've probably led a very, very sheltered internet life. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So I always kind of get a little bit uncomfortable, like denying an advertisement, for example, if it was a little bit saucy or if it was, a little bit playful with sexuality, because, you know, I don't know. I always had a little bit of problem putting myself in the position of saying, oh, no, you shouldn't see that, you know?
Yeah, well, I can do it because I'm comfortable with giving up that income knowing that it will be coming from other sources.
Right. Right.
If I was dependent on advertisement, if that extra $200, $300, $400 a month in advertising that I'm giving up would make my rent, so to speak, then I probably would have a harder time of it. But because I know that that I can make it up with book sales and original art sales and other stuff, then I'm fine getting $100, $200 a month from advertising rather than $600 a month from advertising.
Right.
Well, I think that Dave, you have to understand, or Brad, you have to understand that for Dave, it would harm his business if he ran those ads. You have to decide. It's not just people don't just get handed an audience. You cultivate it. And
yeah,
Dave has spent a lot of time cultivating an audience that now he has got a bit of a responsibility to. I know this sounds kind of funny because it's talking in the opposite way, but like, the Penny Arcade guys have cultivated an audience where they're responsible now for being raunchy and cursing.
Right.
You know, it's like,
that is true.
It's their job to do jokes about, you know, boobs and the F word. That is, hold on. I think Dylan has something he wants to say.
Right. And the thing is, they do it better than anyone. They are definitely the best, you know, if not the best, one of the best strips going online or even in print. But the fact is that they, at this point, because of the readership they've cultivated, they couldn't do a sweet storyline that was endearing or was about, I don't know. I'm trying to think of a strip.
They have a hard time. They have a hard time with it.
For better or for worse. Yeah. I'm sure that there's a part of them because they're like any creator. They're well-rounded people. And I'm sure they have a desire every once in a while to create a story like that, but I'm sure their readership doesn't respond well to it.
And they do. I've talked to them when they struggle with that sometimes, especially if they do anything involving continuity. They tend to stay away from that. And every once in a while they want to do it. They sometimes get a hard time from their heck, I was talking to the guys about how on my store, whenever someone orders a book, I send them a little thank you note. Like I write them a little, hey, thanks for giving Skull a good home when they buy a plush.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, boy, we wish we could do that. The guys at our fulfillment center are trying to get us to do that. And I said, why don't you? And he goes, the response would be, you know, from our fans, they would see it as a sign of weakness. You know? And it's like, hey, thanks for giving the Gabe doll a good home. And then you'd get an email back going like, gay, queer, you know. So,
yeah.
But, you know, I think that's something important. What's important that this leads to for today's episode is think about the audience you're cultivating. Because once you build it, you know, you're stuck within the confines of what you've built, and it's very hard to change it at that point.
Mm-hmm. That is so true.
Well, and a readership is this is probably an imperfect metaphor again, but a readership is in many ways like the circle of friends that you choose to cultivate over years, you know? If you go out drinking every night, the group of friends that you develop will be the bar buddies you sit with every night. And that's going to be a certain type of person. If you go every night to, a church group, your friends are going to be the people in that church group. And it's going to be very different. And so your choices and your decisions in life, much like your choices and decisions as a creator to your readership, will be different depending on the readership you cultivate or the friends you cultivate in real life, you know?
Yeah.
Very.
So, such important life lessons today.
This is a very special episode.
I need a stinger for it. Life lesson.
Where that gets interesting, though, is how, and this is a good follow-up question, is when do you let your readership decide what you do?
Oh, never.
I got to agree with you there.
Yeah. Never.
But some readers have found that they're, like, I think I was talking to Paul Taylor about this at San Diego Comic-Con. Where he was saying, you know, I've done some things in WOTC recently that I'm – this is WOTCSquare.com. I've done some things in WOTC that I've been really happy with, and there's a percentage of my readership that does not like it and is very vociferous about it. And I said, well, good for you for sticking to what you want, because the new readers that you'll gain that will like the new approach will come and they'll follow it. And you may lose some, but you have to maintain the joy that you feel as a creator to doing it, you know?
Well, let me make sure that I don't express this incorrectly. I listen to my readers all the time, and when it's something that doesn't affect the overall vision that I have, I love to do it. Someone mentioned during a current storyline that I'm doing that they wish there was a reference. I'm doing a murder mystery story. They were like, boy, I hope there's a reference to this one murder mystery show I like. Hey, I'll drop it in. Why not? They get a big kick out of it. But if when someone comes in and says, this storyline is dumb, you need to get back to doing jokes about video games, if you respond to that, you're going to really damage yourself.
Right.
It's almost like a little kid that you don't discipline, and deep down, you know, the kid's never going to say, feed me broccoli. They're going to say pizza every night. But if you gave them pizza every night, they're going to end up eventually being miserable. They want a little, you know, discipline, I think, deep down. And your readers want, they've come to this to see your vision. They're going to disagree with you. They're going to, you're going to get posts and emails about how you should change it. But if you just start trying to tailor your strip to individual requests, you're doomed.
Well, yeah, because you can never please everybody, and you might have one reader who's saying that he wants you to get back to the video games, but you might have a silent majority of people who are loving the Jade Fontaine murder mystery.
Yeah. You know?
So then when you decide that you're going to go with one, and you end up leaving a whole bunch of people behind. Yeah. In the end, I think that what you've got to do is trust your judgment as an artist and as a cartoonist.
Right.
And you've got to say, you know what, I got myself this far thinking on my own, and I'm going to get myself the rest of the way too. And certainly listen to what your fans are saying and let that kind of guide you in some general terms. But you can't get involved in trying to play for the Piper because you're never going to be able to keep up.
The only caveat I would make to that is that I feel that in the last couple years, I kind of lost track of the responsibility that I had to my readers. I kind of lost track of what I had cultivated and my end of the bargain, which is they were trying to tell me, you know, and I wasn't paying attention. So in that case, the readers were right.
Mm-hmm.
And I've tried to correct it in these last months, you know. So you got to be honest with yourself, you know. These readers are supporting me. They're keeping me going. The strip should be on time every day. You know, they've given me 10 years of a livelihood. Mm-hmm. They're right when they say the strip should be on time every day, unless I have a good reason.
But that's not a creative issue. That's more, like a logistics nuts and bolts issue.
I'm just trying to avoid emails. I'm covering all my bases. You see, Brad, when you go to the YMCA just to work out, it's great. When you lose track of things, and the next thing you know, you're living out of the YMCA. You're sleeping on a bench and you're giving yourselves a spritz bath in the men's locker room. It's time to reevaluate, you know?
Yeah, and if you do that, remember, underarms first and then the face. Let's have some priorities here.
Yeah, it's like I used to play racquetball with the Penny Arcade guys at the YMCA when we were both yuppies. And then all of a sudden one day I realize they're coming in, they're not talking to me anymore because I'm the dude sleeping in the corner in a wife beater t-shirt, bathing myself like a bird out of the sink. And I'm like, what happened?
What happened to me? I used to see somebody. And meanwhile, there's Gabe and Tycho ka-tunk-tunk in the racquetball court.
Hey, guys, there's someone at my door, so give me 1 second.
Well, we can vamp without you. In fact, Dave, why don't you do the mailbag next? We'll catch you up, Scott.
All right. Let me go to the old mailbag here, going down to the podcast.
Oh, do I get to request an accent?
Sure, if you want, yeah.
I want to request a Transylvanian Dracula accent since we're so close to Halloween. I'm really getting in the Halloween spirit.
What a random question. All right, let's see. Here we go.
Hey, what was the question?
I'm going to read it right now. And Brad requested it in Transylvanian vampire, which I don't know if I'm going to – it's going to end up sounding like the Count from Sesame Street. All right, here we go. Hello, guys. I really like the show. I've got one quick question. I am just starting out. So is it better to put the comics on the side like Drunk Duck that hosts a whole load of comics where maybe I can pick up an audience? Or is it better to risk to get my own site, and if I fail, then I fail? I can see both the pros and cons for both sides.
That was a terrible accent.
Was that Borat?
I was trying to do, you know, it's Transylvanian, it's kind of vaguely Bulgarian.
I make a comic, he's nice.
Is this microphone working? I said Dracula, not Yakov Smirnoff.
You know what? I'm not playing that game.
Yakov Smirnoff. Wow.
It's Transylvania vampire with an IQ.
What's a comic, eh?
Hey.
What a country.
Do you know that Yakov Smirnoff now has his own stage show in Branson, Missouri? That's all he does now.
Oh, no. Please don't tell me that's right. The case.
You have to do a Google search. After we get done with the episode, go do a Google search for Yakov Smirnoff's show in Branson, Missouri.
He and Gallagher are fighting over...
the last two fans.
Yeah.
Please don't get me with those watermelon squeezins, Mr. Gallagher. All right, so there's the question then. What if you're just starting out, what's better to go with? Sort of a shared hosting site like Drunk Duck or Comics Genesis or what else?
I think it's what you can afford. Do you see any reason to, if you can't afford your own site, to not do a Drunk Duck? I mean, what are the benefits to a Drunk Duck or a collective?
I agree with you. My initial thought is that if you can throw up Google Ads, you can pay for hosting of your own site.
It is so cheap now. It is not the same as before.
There is hosting somewhere in the world for under $10 a month if you're just starting out.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just it's a half an hour of searching, but you can find some web server out of Eastern Lithuania that'll host you for $9 a month. And let me tell you, those Eastern Lithuanians, they know how to host. No, throw up some Google ads, throw up some Project Wonderful ads, throw up something, and you can pay for your hosting at the very least. And my thinking on that is that you don't want to build up an audience to a URL that has either Comics Genesis attached to it or Drunk Duck attached to it. And then when you do eventually switch, you're going to have to do all sorts of audience guidance to the new URL. So you might as well start with it and build from scratch.
Yeah, you know what? I think you're right. And I think from the outside, it seems, oh, I'm going to join one of these big collectives because then I'm going to be part of a big group, and I'm going to have that instant sense of community. And I think there is so much community on the web now that I don't think you need that anymore. I think you can easily go out and find groups of like-minded cartoonists and stuff like that where you can have some support, like our own site at halfpixel.com /www. You know, there's a bunch of these little informal groups that kind of pop up, and you can have that sense of community and knowledge sharing and stuff like that, link exchange between comics that are starting out. I don't know what the benefit for a group like Drunk Duck and Comic Genesis is anymore. I knew what it was when I joined.
The only benefit I can think of is if a person just really either has no ability or no desire to figure out how to build their own website or do their own hosting. That's all I can think of.
Right.
And that, for some people, that's a pretty daunting task.
Yeah.
You're right, but don't let, I mean, that also kind of opens up the door to say, well, that's me, so I'm going to just, give it a good try before you decide that you're one of these people that can't. Because, like Dave is saying, it's actually, you know, a little bit easier than you might think. And there are lots of people that have been there that are going to be more than happy to help you out.
Well, and let me give you this comparison. When I bought my first house, one of the things my dad told me, and my dad, when he was raising myself and my brothers and sisters, always had us like working on a transmission or working around the house and all that sort of stuff. Not in a slave labor way, but in the "I'll work next to you, Dad, and I'm going to learn how to do this." When I bought my first house, he said, "Dave, do the plumbing yourself, do the electrical yourself, try to do some stucco or roofing yourself, because then in life you will know how much it's worth it to pay somebody to do it for you."
Wow, is that ever a good idea?
And that's also true with web stuff, is that if you do it and you try the HTML coding and your CSS and then you're trying to figure out how to set up an email system and stuff, you eventually figure out, all right, this is worth it for me to pay somebody $500 to do it for me, or pay $100 to do it for me, or pay $1,000 to do it for me, because you know what the time is worth and you know what the hassle is worth. So in general, that's true with a lot of cartooning business in sort of the entrepreneurial venue of it, is that try to do it once yourself. Try to do your first book all yourself. Try to do your first site all yourself. And then you'll know what it's worth it to you to give up, say, 5% profit sharing or a flat $500 fee or whatever the payment might be, because you know what the level of hassle it was.
Yeah. No, you're right. Listen, if you're serious about making a living out of cartooning and your big impassable, unstoppable force is putting up your own website, you're in big trouble. That's you're going to have to eventually figure it out.
Right, but you know what? I'll soften that a little bit though, and that's why sites like Comics Genesis and Drunk Duck do well, because you might at first consider it to be enough of a hurdle to even start doing a daily or semi-daily or semi-weekly strip, and so you just want to see if you can do that first. And maybe you consider this to be a 10-year stage process, and maybe the first part is just getting it online. So if like Brad said last week, you're suffering from a paralysis of analysis, just get it going on Comics Genesis or Drunk Duck, and then slowly teach yourself HTML, CSS, and all the stuff that you'll need to know.
If nothing else, if you're going to go with a Drunk Duck or Comic Genesis, for sure register your own domain name and point it to whatever URL you're given.
That's true.
Own your URL.
And then all your marketing material can edit cons and stuff. You can say, hey, go to Black Shoe Fridays, and that's my name in my comic strip, Black Shoe Fridays. And
no,
then,
no shoes for Tuesday.
No, that's still stayed in my mind. I was trying to think of something else.
That's our de facto fake web comic name is No Shoes for Tuesday. And by the way, I have already decided that No Shoes for Tuesday is about a cat named Tuesday, and that's why he has no shoes, because he's a cat.
Oh my God.
You got my crazy Mozart laugh out of me. Good job.
No Shoes for Tuesdays appear, by the way, ironically, every Monday.
Just because. But all right, should we go back to the old mailbag?
Please.
Yeah. Brad, you want to read one, or shall I do the next one? Or
listen, this baby here isn't audible, is he? Right? You can't hear him. He's not affecting the show, is he?
Not hardly at all.
He was a minute ago, but he was a cute little. I thought it was.
He's very interested in what we have to say. Hold on, I think he's got something to say right now. I don't know. I wouldn't know what the pacifier is. Hand that guy to me. Let's see what he has to say about this while Dave's getting a new mail from the mailbag.
All right. So I got a question here. All right. This question is from Tobias, and he did not include a website, but that's all right. It says, "Dear fellas, I've been trying to get back into the swing of drawing a daily comic after a 2-year or more hiatus, and one of the things that is killing me on story ideas is reading other comics. It seems like when I read a lot of web comics that my own creation process becomes polluted with other people's ideas, if that makes any sense. Do you guys still read webcomics in general, or are there any that you try to avoid, like comics of the same genre as your own, because you are afraid that you might subconsciously copy someone else's idea? The reason I ask is that recently, while trying to come up with a fresh story idea, I kept thinking about doing a comic about a gaming magazine that is run by supervillains who have a talking duck." Which I thought was a funny ending.
That guy's got a future in comics.
You got moxie, kid. Brad, why don't you start us off there?
Well, I'll tell you what. I don't give a whole lot of credence to the whole "I don't want to read something because I don't want to steal it." Just because that's just a simple matter of self-control. I mean, if you don't want to steal something, don't steal it. And if you make one, and this happens, if you make an honest mistake and end up stealing something subconsciously, then cop to it, smile and blush and wait for the next update. You're going to be doing another comic on the next day. So, honest mistakes are forgivable. And only you yourself know whether you're making an honest mistake or whether you're trying to crib from somebody else. More importantly, though, I think it's a case of what your time management allows. I like reading comics a lot. But what has happened with me is that between family issues and work and doing my comic, I've gone from somebody who in 2001 had, I counted one time, and it was close to, 50 comics a day that I was reading, 50 or 60, including newspaper comics on in the papers and stuff on the web. And I've gone from that to reading maybe 6 a day on a good day. And it's just more or less for me a question of the fact that I just don't have the time to give it. So I don't know anything that's going on out there other than, obviously I keep up with my Webcomics Weekly pals and their strips and a few others that I enjoy too. But I've fallen away from a little bit.
Well, I have strong opinions about this if you want to hear them.
Go ahead.
In ignorance of the law is no excuse. And we don't live in a vacuum, you know? Pop culture is based on the idea that we like repetition. We like to repeat. I mean, pop culture is not based on what's new as it is recalling what's older. You know, we live in a society of nostalgia and references. You have to be aware of what's out there. And the reason why is when they say there's no such thing as a new idea, it's because there's not. But that's not important. What's important is not whether the story you're telling is new. What's important is the spin that you're putting on the story, your way of retelling the story. You know, heck, all these sitcoms are the same. All these movies are the same. They're all basic archetypes. You know, it's just when you get a new spin on it is when things really stand out. Look at The Matrix. What genre is that? Science fiction, fantasy. But what a spin they put on it. What a brilliant way of telling the story differently. But, I mean, how many times have we seen a post-apocalyptic future, you know?
Right.
With a hero's quest embedded in it.
Exactly. What's important is that you're aware of what's going out there. You see what's on the landscape, and you say, How am I going to strike my place in this landscape and be different? You know, how am I going to put my spin on what's popular? You have to be aware of what's out there. If you remain ignorant to it, I think you're going to consign yourself to always being behind the curve and always, I think you run a greater chance of copying somebody. And if you have, and it's because you were ignorant they were there, telling yourself you're not going to read Penny Arcade because you don't want to be accused of maybe copying their joke is like playing hide and seek by standing in the middle of the room and covering your eyes. You know? you've got to get creative about where you're going to hide if you want to play that game. So if you're going to play, you got to participate. You got to be in it. And I think your work will be better for it. One of my favorite games is to open up the newspaper and read the just god-awful strips that are in there and say, all right, here's my challenge. I'm going to take this joke and I'm going to make it funny. I'm going to make it edgier, funnier, or more clever. I'm going to retell it. I never put those in the strip, but it's just as an exercise, you know. It's really funny because when I went and saw, just speaking of The Matrix, when we went and saw episode one, I was very disappointed. And when I went and saw The Matrix, I was blown away. And my friend Richard told me that I have a critic's mind. I have a satirist's mind. So everything I watch, I'm dissecting it so I can make fun of it later or comment on it later. And so I'm always naturally looking for the ins and outs of something. When something catches me off guard and I forget to do that, I genuinely have an opportunity to enjoy it. Uh-huh. And with episode one, I had all these expectations and they weren't met. And my critical thinking was on. But with The Matrix, I was too busy being like, what? But? And so I got to turn off my critical mind and enjoy it. And so, I think I've trained myself to be pretty hyper aware of pop culture and especially in the comic book industry. Boy, that was a long time I talked just now.
Wow. Hey, you know what?
That was inside me. I had to get it out.
I've got to take care of my grandkids real quick, so I'm going to be back in a minute. No, that was good. It was good.
Ooh, that was like a Brad Geiger outro.
There's the Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse. And the thing you hit on, too, is that the idea that nothing new is new. It's just a reimagining and repackaging. I mean, one of the reasons why episode one stunk so bad in comparison to episode four is that Lucas in episode four really stuck to Joseph Campbell's, you know, the hero's journey. And that's exactly what they did with The Matrix, is they used that story construct so perfectly, you know, and combined it with things like, you know, the hair down the well and all that sort of stuff. But episode one had nothing in terms of an archetypal resonance into it. It was just sort of an amalgamation of story bits that you're like, what? You know, and it was sort of half business approach to the empire. Anyway, so Scott's right. I mean, Shakespeare lifted from the Decameron half the time. And which one do you remember? Do you remember the 13th century Decameron or do you remember Shakespeare? You remember Shakespeare because he reimagined a work and made it better and did it. So when you're looking for story structures and story types, there's no fault in going back to the hero's journey or something like that. But I will point out that there is something very different when you're doing a story, a comic story or comic strip, and and you find yourself mimicking or paralleling jokes that have been written or characters that have been written, in no way should you ever consciously crib or copy or lift character elements, character stylizations, joke stylizations. And I think Scott or Brad said it, when it happens, and it will happen to everyone accidentally, you just have to be open and honest about it and say, listen, I apologize. My mind is constantly soaking up things from all around it, and sometimes it gets recontextualized in my own mind where I thought that I came up with this and I didn't. And it will happen to you. One of the things that I always laughed about when I worked at the San Diego Union Tribune briefly as an editorial cartoonist is that I would do a cartoon and I would hand it in to the editor. And literally, he would be pulling stuff off the AP wire at the same time, and there would be three identical cartoons about the exact same story, using the exact same joke, with the exact same characters and visualizations.
It's awful in editorial cartooning. Don't even get me started about my opinions on editorial cartoons.
Because, you know, you have to comment on the same five or six stories, and there's five or six cartoonists all around the country that are looking at it in the exact same way that you are, with the same joke and the same structure. And you're like, damn it, I literally thought I was being inventive here. So you can't be too precious in your creativity and think that the ideas that you come up with, no one else has come up with either. You know?
Oh, my God. Talk about a pool of stagnant creators, hackery, editorial cartooning. Oh, my God.
I guess we're going to segue into editorial
cartoons. Holy cow. Oh, hey, Phil, what's this? Oh, it's today's editorial cartoon. And you look at it, it's a picture of a baby in a top hat, and there's blood everywhere, and a barrel, and the barrel is labeled Big Oil. And then you're like, what does the hat represent? And he goes, I don't know, computers, everything. You know, it's just like, what hackery?
Well,
Where'd that come from?
Wow, somebody got a tripwire pulled there.
Well, just like Dave, I used to do political cartoons, and my in fact, that's how I started into cartooning at all. And I kind of try to judge myself, for one, on the fact that I considered a good idea or a good cartoon if I was able to convey the point without labeling everything that was in the scene. You know, the bucket of oil labeled oil, and the stone labeled stone, and the top hat labeled Afghanistan. You know, it's really a challenge, and particularly now more than ever, it's a challenge to say something that is funny and on the mark and still recognizable. You know,
there's some people in editorial cartooning that just do it brilliantly. And it really makes the hacks stand out. It really makes the and I wonder how much of it is from an editor. I mean, you might know this, Brad, working in a newspaper. I wonder how much of it is from the editorial management telling the cartoonist, hey, keep it easy. Look, all right? You know? Just have the elephant and the donkey looking at each other and going, nobody knows.
Well, I had a talk with Signe Wilkinson about that. She's a Pulitzer Prize-winning editorial cartoonist who works for the Daily News. And she said that very seldom, never do they come up and tell her, your cartoon tomorrow is going to be about, you know, the Democratic presidential candidacy or whatever. You know, she's got pretty free rein to do whatever she wants. But this part she never really talked about. But I have no doubt in my mind that there are times when she might get a little, if not an overt message, maybe more of an implied message, that maybe, you know, she could play this one angle a little bit cooler than others. I don't know that for a fact, but
well,
listen,
I guarantee you that happens, because you have to sell papers, and they're not going to get a blue state liberal slant cartoonist in a red state newspaper here in Texas. You'll never sell any papers.
Right.
Well, and a lot of that, as Brad can, I'm sure, back up, a lot of that has been really toned down in the last 10 years, 20 years, as corporate ownership has taken over from private ownership in newspapers. There's a lot less risk-taking, a lot less willingness to, for lack of a better phrase, piss off certain advertisers or certain interests that make the paper go. But even with private owners, I mean, when I was at the Union Tribune, I did a cartoon that poked fun at some local politics regarding sports stadium financing, and brought it into the editor. And he said, yeah, that's a great cartoon. That's really hilarious.
We're not going to be running that because the owner of the paper has a 20% vested interest in the thing you're making fun of. So I'm like, guess I'm out of that one.
That is awful. That is just sad.
You guys talk about this. What does that mean for the future of editorial cartooning?
I think it doesn't have a good future, unfortunately.
God, I guess it means who gives a crap.
Okay, next topic.
Because who's gives a crap about editorial cartooning now? Unless it's it's tempered inside of a non-editorial. I mean, I got to get to my editorial page because I got to see if every editorial cartoonist drew Governor Schwarzenegger with the gap in his dudes. But the gap's California. Everybody, look, it's because he's in California. Blah.
I disagree. Editorial.
Oh, I can't wait to see 1,000 cartoons about the celebrity that just died entering the gates of heaven in his own Von Beyond way or whatever it is.
Hackery. Yeah. I agree. There's hackery and sometimes, let's face it, when the celebrity passes away, what the people who do turn to the editorial page are looking for and will feel very cheated if they don't get it is the Pearly Gates cartoon.
That's probably true.
Come on. I mean, it's something that it's like a curtain call. You got to do it. I don't think even the hacks, I don't think, enjoy doing the Pearly Gates cartoon, but they got to do it. Let's get serious for a minute here. Editorial cartoons 40 years ago were incredibly powerful. Take a look at the power that Herb Block had in regards to the Nixon administration and what he had, the role that a cartoonist and his cartoons played in the American political process. And that was a very important, very powerful, very necessary thing, as necessary as journalism itself. And we've given up a lot of that. And the bad thing is,
you're not going to find that on the editorial cartoon page now.
No, but that's what I'm working up towards here. Is that it seems like everything else has found new life on the internet and on the World Wide Web. Journalism is finding a renaissance of sorts on the web. You know, there's a lot more that can be done there than it is done in print. And cartooning, I mean, we know ourselves, the comic strip that used to be fettered by a newspaper print, it has an entire renaissance, but I don't see a renaissance of editorial cartooning happening on the web. And I'll tell you why I think that is. That is that a really good editorial cartoonist has to be forced on you, and it has to be somebody that puts a opinion in your face, especially when you disagree with it, and still makes you chuckle and then burn your blood and feel bad. But it's got to be something that is forced on you. And on the internet, nothing is forced on you. If you're a conservative, you're never going to go to a liberal liberal cartoonist's website to be purposefully upset. And if you're vice versa, and I don't see editorial cartoonists thriving in the internet age, and I think that's a really terrible thing.
Yeah, it's unfortunately, I think it. You're right, Brad, that the key element that needed to happen was an editorial and business decision that this is going to move papers, so whether people like it or not, and because we've got to compete with the crosstown Detroit News, well, by gosh, the Detroit Times is going to have so-and-so be our cartoonist. And it worked within that business model, but it doesn't necessarily work online. And there are popular... say, for example, I can't remember the name of it at the moment, but there's a right-wing comic strip that's primarily online, and I can't remember the name, that does huge numbers. But you never see a liberal reader going to read it because it's by choice. It's an active choice on conservative readers to go read it.
Right, and you wouldn't necessarily choose to go and get yourself upset by reading that opinion that you might very much disagree. And I think it's also I think American politics have gotten incredibly polarized now, and you can't. There used to be a lot of fun that you could play in the middle, and now everything is liberal, 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 conservative, 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 and there's no room in the middle where you can have some fun.
Right, and I think you've hit on something that are probably 10,000 dissertations being written about in communications and journalism schools right now, which is how do you recapture that middle where you can – because, you know, the average person likes to hear viewpoints that are reasonable and sound from both sides of the spectrum, but you just don't see it much online. Anyway, shall we go on to the next question, fellas?
Hey, yeah. Do you guys realize that we're past an hour now?
Well, let's finish off with one more.
Let's wrap it up here after this one.
Actually, that was the last one we were going to do.
How about that, David? Hey, you know what? I've got one that just came in to me. If you guys are looking to go out on a high note, and this might be something I don't know. Tell me if we want to hold it for next time.
No, let's do it now.
Yeah, let's do it.
I've been doing my comic for 9 months, 3 times a week without fail. But lately, I've been getting these, why the heck am I doing this feelings? Like I've hit a wall. Are these feelings normal?
Ooh.
Oh, my God, yes.
Yes.
Absolutely, yes.
That's what I think. I think we can help this guy out in about 5 minutes by saying, yes, there's nothing abnormal about looking at a drawing board full of sketches and 9 months down the road of looking in your rearview mirror at, you know, however many strips that are, and, you know, maybe your site hasn't taken off and CNN hasn't been calling to say, hey, tell me about your comic strip. And it's absolutely normal to have those feelings.
Oh, I got to tell you, you know, I mean, I've been going over this with Chris, trying to encourage him, because I mean, when I started PvP, I mean, my God, my marriage was suffering. I was working a day job and coming home and working on the strip. I never saw her. We led practically separate lives, and there was nothing. There wasn't a store. There wasn't book sales. It was all in the sense of, I hope this pays off someday, somehow, you know? And you know, luckily she was super cool with that. But yeah, you do question it. But you also at the same time are like, I've got to keep going, because what if the opportunity comes around and I'm not ready for it?
Right.
I know, it feels like you're constantly getting dressed up for a date that you hope is going to show up.
Boy, is that ever a good analogy. And YMCA didn't play a damn part of it.
Oh, I cursed. I'm sorry. That's all right. But that's why, I don't know if you guys remember me saying this maybe 4 or 5 podcasts ago, but that's why I was saying you have to want this more than most things, if not almost everything in your life, because there are literally years of sacrifice, because it's not a job that you do intensively for 3 weeks and then go easy on, and then intensively for 3 weeks and then go easy on. It's every day or every second day, or, you know, however you set up your schedule. And it can take a real toll on both your emotional health and on your relationship. And like Scott, I was working at Mattel for 8 years while building up Sheldon's readership. And I would most nights go to bed 3 a.m. and then get back up 7:30 or 8 to go to work at Mattel. And it's not an accident that I'm prematurely gray. I didn't get a lot of sleep for like 6 years there. It took its toll on relationships, because my wife, who is a writer and has these periods of intense work moments, and then has a few weeks off, and then intense work moments, and then a few weeks off, would look at me in some days and go and say, just don't do the strip today. What does it matter? Just don't do the strip. And I was like, no, you don't understand. This is an industry where you're only as good as your last strip, and part of the implicit contract with your readers is that you will be there every day with a strip. And it's tough. It takes its toll. But if you truly want it, you will figure out a way to make it work. And for me, that meant giving up a lot of things. I don't play much video games anymore. I don't get to do as much casual reading as I used to do.
I heard somebody started playing some video games recently.
I did start playing Halo 2. Bad move on my part. But but no, you have to. And because the things that are worth it in life are worth sacrificing for. And if you truly wanted to do cartooning and comic strip cartooning or long form cartooning online, there's going to be a lot of sacrifice, and there's going to be a lot of moments of self-doubt. And so to carry you through those moments, you have to know that you want this more than a lot of things in life.
Boy, it's the truth.
There's no way of putting that any better, Dave.
Wow. Well, wait, I think I can put it better. Listen, life is like the YMCA. And cartooning is like
the pool.
Underwear. And sometimes you work out a lot, and all you end up with is one underwear up your butt, and you got to pull it out. But you keep squatting. Keep doing those squats, because you're building leg strength. What? No, Brad, Dave, let's do an outro.
Okay. You have been listening to the Webcomics Weekly podcast with with your three friends minus one. We're going to mention Chris in absentia. He wasn't here. He's at starslip.com. Over there on the east west coast is Dave Kellett at sheldoncomics.com. Our good friend Scott Kurtz at pvponline.com, and me, I'm Brad Geiger at evil-comic.com.
And our impromptu guest panelist that took Chris's spot, my nephew Dylan, who's at
Dylan.
com, apparently.
Dylan can be found at noshoesfortuesday.com.
Yeah, no shoes for Tuesday. Oh, that crazy cat Tuesday. No shoes. All right, well, until next week, keep cartooning. Hey, how many YMCA memberships do you think we drove today? Dave, you need to call them and let them know that we've done some reverse sponsoring. They owe us money.
Thank God I signed us up for commission-based sales.
Are they paying per click or per CPM? I'm unsure.
Per word, per weird person that signs up for membership.
That's awesome.